It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a historian joins the show for a look at the many ways that the internet and social media are changing our understanding of the past. First, the 4th annual Black Arts Matter Festival kicks off today in Madison. The fest brings together music, visual art, and spoken word poetry to celebrate Black creativity. Events run through this Sunday, November 12th. Shasperay Irvin is co-founder and artistic director of the Black Arts Matter Festival. She's also a performance artist and ranked 4th at the 2022 Women of the World Poetry Slam. I talked to her earlier today. Now, this is, I understand, the 4th year for the Black Arts Matter Festival. You founded it back in 2019. Can you talk about the need that you saw and the vision for what the festival could be?
Yes, of course. So in 2019, I was in my undergraduate program, the theater department at UW-Madison. I noticed that there was a love for the arts and humanities in Madison across the board, but for the art forms that I participated in, Poetry Slam, for example, or Black Arts, I noticed that there was just kind of a lack of that in town, in Madison, on campus. So I wanted to provide a space, because I was always traveling out of town for festivals, to get that art.
And you started in 2019, then we had COVID, but you still got it going in 2023. How did you keep the festival rolling through some difficult times?
Yeah, due to the partnership with the Wisconsin Union Theater, they are producing the festival and have been. We actually had a completely virtual festival in 2020, so that was a really interesting year. We got to play with hosting a virtual festival and returned in 2022 and now 2023. So due to their partnership and the fundraising and grants they've been able to secure, we've been able to keep things growing and going.
You mentioned poetry slams, a lot of spoken word poetry. For people who have never been to one of these, what could they expect?
Yeah, so November 10th, we are having a poetry slam. That is something that has been a part of every festival. A poetry slam is a poetry competition where poets compete with their original works. They do original poetry from the stage, spoken word, and they're judged by randomly selected or pre-selected judges, and they compete for prizes. This year, they're competing for $3,000, $2,000, $1,000. And these are poets from all over, the top-ranked poets from all over the country coming into Madison.
What other things can people visit over the course of the festival?
Yeah, so tonight we actually have an opening reception, a celebration of 4 years of festivals with DJ Femme Noir, who's a local DJ legend in town, of which we'll have free food, so come to that. we have the Poetry Slam. We'll also have headlining Tank and the Bangas performing, Grammy-nominated artist. Super excited for that. Then we will have, we're engaging youth actually for the first time. So at My Arts on East Mifflin Street, we're actually going to be having a youth talent competition where there's going to be elementary, middle school, and high school categories for competition, as well as a vendor and art market in My Arts on the 12th.
And if people want to find out more, if they're in Madison or want to visit, where can they go for info?
Yeah, so you can always visit the Black Arts Matters Festival .org or head to the Wisconsin Union Theater website for more information about the full events. Either is fine.
Shasperay, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Shasperay Irvin is founder and artistic director of the Black Arts Matter Festival based in Madison. It starts today and runs through Sunday. Now, thanks to the internet and social media, there are lots and lots of ways to access lessons about history. From Wikipedia to TikTok, there's plenty of content about history that tries to grab our eye. But whether it's complete and accurate, that's another question. Our next guest calls it e-history, and his latest book digs into how the internet is changing our relationship with the past. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to read up or listen up on history online? Have you ever come across an article or an image about history, wondered if it was the real deal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Steinhauer is a public historian and author. His latest book is called History Disrupted: How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past. He was a keynote speaker at the Local History and Historical Preservation Conference in La Crosse last month. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As you explain in your book, e-history covers a lot of ground, a lot of internet content. Can you give us a sense of the scope and the kinds of things we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a huge universe of content. On a platform like TikTok, for example, at this time last year, there were 58 billion posts with the hashtag history, 58 billion posts with the hashtag history. That was a year ago, so now it's well over 100 billion. On Instagram, it's somewhere in the range of 40 to 50 million. Again, that was last year, so now it's probably well over 100 million. And that's just with the hashtag history. It doesn't even include other content that alludes to history or tries to teach you something about the past or claims to be teaching you something about the past. So it's a huge universe of content. We are constantly seeing images about the past and information about history in our newsfeed every single day at any given time.
One concern you have is that a lot of times you talk to people who describe themselves as fans of some of the different kinds of content, who when they sit back and think and talk about it, think, yeah, I enjoy it, but I don't really feel like I'm learning that much from it. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. You know, as part of this project and part of the work I do, I interviewed a lot of people of all different ages and backgrounds. And, you know, they'll confess that they might spend an hour or two on their phone scrolling through social media, seeing lots of e-history content as well as other types of content. And then they look up and realize that they don't remember a single thing that they looked at. Right. It's like we have all this information around us, but how much of it is actually getting through? How much of it is actually stuff that we are remembering, that we are actively learning, which is why I say that even though we're encountering a lot of e-history content online, that doesn't actually mean that we're learning anything about history. And a lot of this just goes back to how social media platforms are designed, right? They're designed a lot like slot machines. If you go to a casino and you see people in front of a slot machine, what they're getting addicted to is actually just the process of pulling the lever and having a different result show up each time. And you'll find that people can sit in front of a slot machine for hours at a time and not really even know what they're doing, just continually pulling the lever. And social media has that same effect. You end up getting stuck on your phone scrolling passively without even really realizing what you're doing. And then when you look up, you don't even know what you encountered. So you're getting addicted to the process of scrolling. You're not really absorbing any of the information.
Another concern you raise is about the source of the material. Now, someone who's an expert who's spent their whole life studying, say, I don't know, ancient Roman history could post something on TikTok. I could post something on TikTok about the same topic. I promise you they know a lot more than I do. That doesn't mean their post is going to get any more attention than mine does. Can you talk about this idea of democratizing the internet when it comes to sharing information about history?
Yeah. So what I learned researching the book was the visibility of a piece of e-history in our news feeds has no correlation to the accuracy of that information. In other words, you could put up a piece of e-history about Napoleon or Julius Caesar or the Holocaust, and it could be incredibly accurate, scholarly, rigorously researched, etc., and it might achieve no visibility online. And then to your point, someone who knows nothing about those topics could put up a piece of e-history about any one of those things and achieve great visibility and influence online. It turns out that accuracy has no bearing on how far and wide a piece of information will travel. What seems to be the real determinant is how well the content aligns with the values that are embedded in the social media platforms themselves. In other words, there are certain assumptions that have gone into the creation of these platforms, certain assumptions that have gone into the design of the algorithms. And the more that a piece of e-history content leverages those assumptions, leverages those algorithms, and leans into the values of social media itself, the more visibility the content seems to achieve. And that has profound implications for the types of information that we see in our phones and in our news feeds each day, because we're not necessarily seeing the most accurate. We're seeing the information that best aligns with the values of the social web itself.
there's another step that seems in some ways to be the most dangerous thing you call attention to, that people with certain political perspectives can create content online, again, with a view not so much for accurate history as for history that aligns with their values and hopefully sways other people toward those values, or even more extreme, disinformation actors wanting to spread false information about the history, especially behind a current conflict. How ripe is that for abuse?
Well, listen, we are constantly being bombarded by information each day that attempts to persuade us to one thing or another. And sometimes that's advertising and marketing content, and sometimes it's political campaigns, and other times it's disinformation campaigns that are leveraging history. And, when we think about our own context in the United States, certainly over the past few years, we have seen evidence of this. We've also seen evidence of it in Europe, in the Middle East, in China, and other places. History is a very powerful discipline, right? Information about the past really does shape and inform how we view the present and the future. And so there are all sorts of nefarious actors out there who are taking elements of the past and tweaking it or distorting it or presenting it in a way with an ultimate purpose of either persuading us to believe one thing or another, to doubting certain things that we think that we know, or purposely trying to cause divisions in society to get us to attack one another. And history, e-history online, turns out plays a critical role in that. And there are lots of examples both in the book as well as on my Substack newsletter where I go into how that plays out and what types of campaigns we're talking about.
Talking to historian Jason Steinhauer, author of the book History Disrupted, about how social media and the internet change the way we understand the past, not always for the better. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a general interest in history? Where do you go for information about it? Do you look for books? Do you go to social media, YouTube for videos, for example, or a podcast? Do you worry about its accuracy? If so, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Jason Steinhauer, historian and author of the book History Disrupted, How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you seek out information about history, where do you go for it? Are there things online that you think have really been rewarding, interesting, and informative? Join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Jason, wanted to ask you about what you would hope to see from historians and academia in supporting those historians when it comes to reaching out with better researched, better contextualized history.
Principally, I'd like to see more funding. To be honest, the history profession is increasingly under funding pressures. I actually saw that very starkly when I was in Wisconsin at the conference a couple weeks ago as the keynote speaker. I went to a couple of panels and heard from local historical societies across the state just how much of a struggle it is to continue to raise money, to bring in funds, to bring in visitors, to recruit donors, to support the type of work that history organizations and history professionals want to do when it comes to public engagement and reaching out on the web and on social media and putting accurate history into the public domain. All of that takes a tremendous amount of work, a tremendous amount of resources, and it's oftentimes resources and staff and training that institutions and historians don't have. And so part of what we've been trying to do through my History Communication Institute, which is the organization that I started a couple years ago, is to bring more funding into this space to help publicly engaged scholars do this type of work.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Darlington. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I will admit that I'm a huge fan of history content on the internet, especially YouTube. And I think it's really wise to caution people about, quality is not always there. You know, you have to be a real critical thinker when you're consuming this content. I do just have a couple follow-up questions, though, that your expert follow-up questions about comments that your expert made. One was The comment was that there's no correlation between quality and accuracy compared to popularity. Mm-hmm. And my follow-up question is that was there a regression study on that, or is that an opinion? And my second follow-up question, then I'll take your comments off the air. My second follow-up question is, you said that what does control popularity of content is the values of the platform. And certainly it's based on algorithms, but I'm not sure that's true, because I happen to know that the popularity of YouTube content, for example, tends to mostly have to do with how many people liked that content, how many people commented on that content. And that is, I consider to be a pretty big indicator of perhaps quality, but also the entertainment value of the content, and not necessarily directly just values or whims of the platform creator. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on those follow-up questions.
John, thanks for the call. Jason, do you want to flesh that out a little?
Yeah, so I'd say that to the first question, so that's research that was done over 5.5 years. That's all detailed in the book. Don't have time today to go through all of it, but if you're interested in it, I would encourage you to pick up the book. It's called History Disrupted: How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past, and it's peer-reviewed, highly footnoted, so you can see where all that information comes from and decide for yourself what you think about it. The second question is sort of related to the first in some way. I would say this, right? The platforms, as I mentioned, they have certain assumptions built into them. And one of the assumptions that built into them is that the more attention that people are giving something, the more visibility it should be given in the feed. So this kind of reinforces what the caller was saying, right? That's an assumption that is built into many platforms, including YouTube, that visibility is oftentimes linked with how many people in a crowd are commenting or looking at something. That has no correlation with accuracy, right? Because lots of people can be looking at something and commenting on something, and it could be wildly inaccurate. And so I guess that's kind of what I'm trying to get people to think about critically, is just because something is getting a lot of views and getting a lot of comments, and as a result, getting a lot of visibility in your feed and showing up on your phone when you go to YouTube and conducting searches, that doesn't mean that it's accurate. That doesn't mean that it's based on the most recent scholarship. That doesn't mean that it aligns with what professional historians think about a particular subject. And YouTube doesn't take what professional historians think about a particular subject into consideration when it's creating and ranking its algorithm. So that's what I mean by, like, the assumptions that go into the algorithm are what dictates visibility. And that has profound consequences for what we see and what we don't see.
John, thanks for that call. Talking to Jason Steinhauer, historian, author of the book History Disrupted: How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past. Sarah joins us now in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi there. Well, I have had this pet peeve in the last few weeks because I'm a Beatlemaniac from back in the 70s. I'm not quite old enough to be one in the 60s, but so I've been really into reading about them and sharing stories about them on the social media site I'm on. And I've just found that the younger fans and even some of the older ones, they just believe a lot of things that are just completely not true because it's just shared on the internet so often. You get these supposed facts that people share, and they're just not true. And there's a couple sites online that are very authentic. I mean, the really well researched. And if you go to there, you get the right information. But not that many people will go to these sites. They just believe what they read. And I've been a little bit upset lately because I feel like in 50 years, no one's going to really know. There'll be all this just made up stuff, or the mythology about the Beatles is going to be what they believe, and it's just not true.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Jason, you write in the book, it's not just the Beatles. We end up with sometimes a popular consensus on history that, as Sarah suggests, they have nothing to do with the actual history.
Yeah, and Wikipedia is a great example of this, and I appreciate Sarah's comment because that's exactly what I was trying to illustrate with the last point, right? If a lot of people believe something, even if it's not accurate, even if it's not grounded in what actually happened, it can take on a life of its own very quickly online. And on Wikipedia, for example, I have examples of this in my book. If enough editors and contributors get behind some sort of myth or popular consensus that isn't actually true or isn't actually accurate or isn't grounded in what actually happened, it can sort of take on a life of its own and show up in the entry. And then once it's on Wikipedia, because so many people go to Wikipedia for information, it can then spread very quickly. So for example, YouTubers who make history videos, they're not doing original research most of the time. What they're doing is going to Wikipedia, taking the information that's there, and then repurposing it into a video. So if consensus forms on Wikipedia that something is true that isn't, it can then be picked up by YouTubers, by TikTokers, by Amazon Alexa, and spread very quickly across the web. And sooner rather than later, you have the phenomenon that was just described, that there's a whole world out there that believes X when the truth was actually Y.
Thanks for that call. Jason, in our just last half a minute, if somebody's out there thinking, gosh, I'm interested in history, I'm not a professional, well, where the heck should I start? Do you have some starting points for them?
Well, I would say first one would be my Substack newsletter, jasonsteinhauer.substack.com, because what I try to do is actually not recommend particular sites or platforms one over the other because there's so much content out there, but rather give people tools through which to think about these issues. And a lot of those tools and a lot of those case studies are on my Substack newsletter. So if you go there, you'll start to see some different ideas and insights into how we deal with this massive e-history universe that we have created. And hopefully some of those can then be useful as people navigate across the web.
Jason, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Steinhauer, public historian and author. He talked to us about his book, History Disrupted, How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past, looking at how we treat history on the internet. We'll get a link up to that newsletter he just mentioned over at WPR.org/Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Between 1970 and 2020, the average household size in Wisconsin has dropped from 3.22 people to 2.36 people. That's according to U.S. Census data. The national numbers show a similar downward trend, but Wisconsin household sizes are now lower than the national average. Now that switch, 3.22 to 2.36, might not sound that far apart, but it represents a significant dip, especially when it comes to the housing stock that's available and attractive to individual people and to families with smaller households. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum dug into this census data and explored some of the factors behind the shrinking household size over the last half century, looked at why Wisconsin households are decreasing faster than national numbers. Our next guest is an expert on housing in the state. He joins us for a look at a mismatch between the size of our families and the size of our available housing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? How big is your household? How does that compare to the one you grew up in? And are you finding a house or an apartment of the right size to match the number of people? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt Paulson is an associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. His research focuses on affordable housing policy, municipal finance, and land use. Kurt, thanks for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, those numbers seem pretty small and not that far apart, but it's a pretty big deal, right, this dip in household size?
Right. And if you multiply it by the millions of households, right, it becomes quite a demographic shift. And so what it means is that you're having a rise of 1- and 2-person households in the state of Wisconsin. And over the last decade, we've actually shrunk in terms of the 3-, 4-, and more-person households. And so that means it's both seniors who are staying in their homes, right? And obviously, maybe a spouse or partner has died, the kids have moved on. But it's also young folks just starting out.
And Wisconsin seems to be decreasing at a faster pace than the country as a whole. Are we just older in general in Wisconsin? Is that the big part of the story there?
Yes. I mean, we like to joke about it, but Wisconsin is kind of old and cold, right? So we're not seeing a lot of the same in-migration that we're seeing in Texas, California, Florida, right? So most of the people who move here move when they're younger. They move for jobs, and then they tend to stay here. So our demographics are aging at a faster rate than other southern states, and our housing stock is also aging because we're just not building enough to keep up with demand.
And do we know about where in the state household sizes are changing? Is this like a global phenomenon in Wisconsin, or I guess statewide phenomenon in Wisconsin, or is this concentrated in urban areas, or what?
It's actually both, but it's for different reasons. So in a lot of our rural areas and small towns, household size is going down because people are aging and young people are moving out. Here in Dane County and in Milwaukee, household size is decreasing largely because young people are moving in, right? So in some ways, it's where you capture people on that circle of life, we would say, right? When you're young, you start out in an apartment, you have a job, right? And then you eventually maybe meet someone, you have a family, you have a house, then you want to downsize, you become a senior. So it's largely driven by these demographic shifts, older population, and younger people are not having as many children, and they're not having them as early in life as previous generations.
Talking to Kurt Paulson, professor and expert on housing at UW-Madison, looking at a mismatch here in the state, not just in Wisconsin, but definitely in Wisconsin. Smaller household sizes, smaller families, houses not keeping up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. All right, Kurt, that's the household size. Now, what about the buildings, the apartments and houses that are in existence that these people want to live in?
Right. So I think the term mismatch is a really good way to think about it, right? Because households come in all different sizes, flavors, income levels. And to make a balanced housing market, you need housing of every different size and type. So the market for years, given our zoning regulations and the financing, really preferred that large kind of new build suburban style house. So three or four bedrooms, right? 2,500 to 3,000 square feet. We build a lot of those, the large single family homes. And then we build a lot of more urban apartments, one or two bedrooms. So a lot of planners, designers, policymakers are looking at what we call the missing middle. That's that in-between product. We used to build a lot of in cities, right? This could be everything from boarding houses to what we call granny flats or accessory dwelling units. It's the duplex, the townhouse, the condos we were talking about. We just don't build a lot of that and have not for 40 years. And so when you have a one or two person household, whether a senior or a young person, you can either rent an apartment, and even apartments are difficult if it's a two bedroom. That's a lot of square footage. That's an expensive house. Or there's just not that much households that want to buy that large single-family house or can afford it.
Now, let's talk about somebody maybe early in their career, and they're thinking, yeah, I want to do the old thing, partner up. That's two people, have a kid or two to bring it up to three or four. Can you talk about what options are out there or not out there when it comes to graduating up through the housing they would want?
And that's a good way to put it. So if I think about my generation, my parents' generation, baby boomers, first-time home buyers or that entry-level house would have been a smaller house to own, like a two or three-bedroom, maybe 1,200 to 1,500 square feet, the kind of older house we grew up in. That doesn't exist, or it's in short supply, or it's really expensive. So what we see in the data is that millennials in particular, right, 25 to 34-year-olds, they are at peak home buying years, peak childbirthing years, they're delaying having children and getting married because there's no place to buy. And it's hard to have children in a two-bedroom rental in a downtown environment.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hello.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. So I'll try to condense this. I'm a two-person household. I'm a single dad. I'm 35, but I have my child early at 20, so a lot earlier than a lot of the people I went to school with. Another thing I've noticed, in addition to issues with housing availability or affordability, and it's especially hard to save when rents are increasing and there's fewer affordable places available near the jobs, but also that a lot of people that I graduated with, or a lot of young people generally, are going out of state, often after graduating college or something like that. Places like Minnesota with like paid family medical leave, stronger worker protections, child care programs that are through the state, free breakfast or free meals, all those things, you know, even something as small as like legal cannabis, I know have made a number of neighboring states especially very attractive to a lot of folks that I know.
Michael, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Michael said basically five different things that could be subjects of entire half-hour conversations. Kurt, I want to start with one early on there, people paying so much in rent that they can't save up for down payment to buy.
Right. And so it's a double whammy, right? Because the product is not there. The kind of lower-priced starter home is not there. And your dollars go a lot less far because interest rates are high. It's actually a triple whammy. And then you can't save for the down payment because rent is high. And to Michael's point, I think it is a workforce recruitment and retention issue because young folks, if they can't find homes to buy in Wisconsin communities, they're going to move to other states. And so growing our population base, you know, I hear all across the state, right? We've got jobs, we can't get people. Well, you can't get people if you don't have housing. And I'll just say one more thing,
sure.
Which is he said he was a single dad. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who is a single parent has a lot of challenges because you just can't put the income together necessarily to buy a house. So one of the structural barriers is what would happen if we said a couple of single parents could buy a place together and kind of share cooking and living expenses, kind of pool your resources like we used to do. Oftentimes in the zoning ordinances, you can't live together unless you're a biological family.
Thanks again for that call, Michael. And I wanted to talk about the role of zoning in all this. I keep hearing concerns about you can't have that grandma flat or what other auxiliary building where one person can rent from you. Boarding houses, I think, are probably out of the picture in a lot of communities because of zoning. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yep.
We've zoned out a lot of potential solutions here, right?
Right. And so cumulatively over the last really 100 years, a lot of that kind of flexible, more urban housing product of the boarding house, right? That's where people used to live. My mom would talk about my grandma taking in boarders in the 1920s. This is what people did. And boarding houses have been zoned out. Again, that accessory dwelling unit. And then the other issue we might want to address is the zoning defines single family housing, mm-hmm. and it defines what is a family. So again, if you had four or five young people or seniors who want to live together to share living expenses, that's one way to make it affordable. Oftentimes they are prohibited from doing that by the zoning because the zoning wants that kind of younger nuclear family with children.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison, looking at household size in Wisconsin. It's shrunk faster in the last 50 years than the rest of the country, and what that means for housing, the size of houses and apartments not always matching up with the sizes of the households. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the effects of smaller household sizes? When you look for a place to live, is there something that's the right size for you, whether it's just you or you and one or two or other three family members? Have you tried to set up a roommate scenario? Was that available to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about housing in Wisconsin and a mismatch between what's available and what the average household size is as over 50 years, according to a new Wisconsin Policy Forum analysis, our average household size has gone down over the last 50 years or so. Kurt Paulson stays with us, associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences, maybe your solutions. Go back to your calls now with Carrie in Kronenwetter. Carrie, hello.
Hi. I just have a point to make. A lot of communities
have a minimum square foot requirement in regard to how large of a home you can build. And this translates into what they get in property taxes, you know, as they're based on the square footage of a house. My husband and I were in our 60s, and we had to get permission to build a 1,500 square foot house.
And did you get that permission, Carrie?
Yes, we did, but it was the bare minimum that they would let us do.
Interesting. Carrie, thanks so much for sharing that point and your story. Kurt?
Yeah, I've heard this around the state. This is true up in Cronenwetter. I've heard it in Adams County, a lot of smaller towns, rural areas. They have these minimum sizes, largely a relic of the past in zoning, where they really wanted to maybe avoid overcrowding, or maybe near a college campus, they don't want kind of a party house. But as Carrie's points out, this really inhibits housing choices for people, whether they're seniors or young people starting out. And so one of the easiest things we can do as a state is have local governments just eliminate minimum housing sizes. You know, if you say, she said 1,500 square foot, that's three bedrooms. That really limits who can live there to a family that's large enough or has enough income to afford it. You know, what is wrong, I always say, with an 800 square foot house, a little two bedroom, one bath, the type of cottages you see in every neighborhood that was built before 1950? That's kind of that starter home, that move down house for seniors, in the same way that there's frequently minimum sizes on apartments. And for a young person starting out, or a person who doesn't want to own a car and wants to live close to downtown, there's nothing wrong with a 400 or 500 square foot apartment, right? So we've really kind of squeezed out that kind of flexibility in housing sizes to allow everyone who wants to kind of choose the housing that fits their size. So this is a great call from Carrie, right? Across the state, we're really shooting ourselves in our foot by having a minimum house size. There are building codes, right, which will stop an overly small house. So there's still building codes. I would say, though, that within the zoning and the subdivision codes, get rid of minimum house sizes.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call. Something I think you and I have talked about in the past, Kurt, is, okay, even if it's allowed, do builders want to build smaller houses these days, or is there more money in it for them to make the bigger stuff?
Well, it's a chicken and egg thing, right? Because if I'm a builder, there's plenty of opportunities to build the kind of custom, higher-end luxury housing. But if we think of the single-family market, there's a lot of developers who want to build that kind of smaller product that people want, right? There's a huge demand for what we might call a cottage cluster, or a kind of more carriage-style house for seniors, for young folks. So it's a matter of economics, right? If the minimum zoning says a 10,000 square foot lot, that's about a quarter of an acre, and if I'm paying $90,000 for the land and the infrastructure, there's no way you're going to build a small house on an expensive lot. So one of the things we're saying around the state, we're seeing a lot of cities and counties really move into this area, is can we reduce the lot sizes, allow more flexibility in setbacks and housing types? You can bring down that price of the lot, and then developers can respond by building that kind of more custom, smaller home product. If you're in the Madison area, there's a cottage cluster out on the west side called Chapel View. These are really small houses on small lots, and they're selling like hotcakes because there's a demand for people to buy either that, you know, first house as starting out, or that kind of move down house after the kids move out.
Let's go back to our callers. Jim is with us in Iola. Jim, hi.
Hi. It was an interesting conversation that you're having here. I was talking to the person that answered, and this was like in the early to mid 70s, that when I was growing up, I lived at home with my folks. My dad worked at Wisconsin Electric, and he'd be hooking up all these neighborhoods. And I remember him one night in particular talking about there was a plot of land southeast side of town where, you know, Vans Construction, that was the name of the business, were putting up homes, three-bedroom, 1,200 square feet, you know, box shape, 30 by 40-foot size homes. And that they had different crews you know, building these things. You know, you had, you know, to put the foundations in and, you know, frame it up and all that stuff. And anyways, to get to my statement here, they were opening up like one house a day. in the mid-70s. I remember him talking about that, and, well, then the weird thing is years later, I bought one of those houses. Okay? And, you know, they're all kept up really nice. You know, these houses now appreciate in value over $200,000, $250,000. And one went up for sale across the street from me and was sold the first day.
Wow. Jim, yep. Thanks a lot for sharing that experience. I don't know, do we make them like that anymore, Kurt?
No, and that's a great story, right? Mm-hmm. That's a classic illustration of what we used to build. We used to build that three-bedroom, 1,200 square foot, right? And when you build a large subdivision and you can kind of almost assembly line the framing crews, the contractors, the basements, right? The most famous example is, of course, on Long Island,
Levittown,
yep. Right? Where you would just mass produce housing. And in particularly the post-war period in the 70s, when you build a lot of housing, that housing becomes affordable, right? And so we've also had some shakeout in the construction industry. After the great financial crisis, a lot of people left the industry. So the total number of people employed building housing in the state of Wisconsin is a lot less today than it was in 2005, even though we've added 500,000 people. So even if we kind of waved our magic wand and we said we want to build a lot more housing, smaller lots, we also need to retrain and regrow the workforce of people to build those houses. Now, there is some possibility, innovation, that you could build those units in a factory, right, where you can have some robots, you have better climate control, because Wisconsin is hard to frame other than 6 months in the year, and maybe deliver and build those, assemble those products on site. So that's where we need to innovate and get back to building a lot of that kind of entry-level housing. Because when you don't build it for 50 years, boy, you really notice it when it's gone.
Thanks for that call, Jim. Mike joins us now in Beaver Dam. Mike, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. And I just wanted to ask Kurt some advice. I have a younger family and a 20-year-old who's in college. And he actually is not able to find any housing. And so we actually took him and his girlfriend in to our own home. And, you know, they're living in a basement apartment pretty much. And so I'm just wondering if he has any advice for parents such as myself with kids in this situation.
And, Mike, where is he going to school?
He's actually going to a technical college for automotive.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Mike. Just wondered how far the commute might be. Yeah. Kurt, any thoughts?
Well, this is funny because I also have a 20-year-old son in college, and we were talking about his housing yesterday. He's up in St. Paul, and much like at UW campus here, you know, the shortage of housing affects students too, because whether it's in Beaver Dam or in Madison, there's just a shortage of units everywhere. And so the kind of cheaper, low amenity housing that a lot of us lived in as students, that's just not available. Because, you know, think of Madison, where families want to live in the same houses that students do. So the advice I would give to everybody is, unless we come together to solve this housing shortage, you better be prepared for your kids coming back to live with you. Well, the other solution is, you know, allow a bunch of students who may be near a technical college or a university to rent a home together or to move in together and share living expenses, right? And again, you can understand why, especially when a college town, you want to avoid the parties. But if you're concerned about parties or traffic, regulate for that. Don't regulate for the number of people who can live together. I mean, one of the ways to solve this problem of single-person households, right, is to allow more people to live together in a less-than-traditional relationship in the house.
Mike, thanks for that call. Just our last half a minute or so, Kurt, do you get the sense that policymakers at state and local levels are starting to see this as a problem and take it seriously?
Yes. I mean, you see around the state that every local official, they say housing is their biggest issue, and they understand that we can't keep doing what we've done. We have to open up the flexibility to allow more people to live together, to create that condo for seniors to move down into, to open up that single-family home, to allow smaller houses on smaller lots. And there was recent legislation at the state that gives municipalities and developers a lot of financial resources to make those zoning and subdivision reforms to free up our housing supply.
Kurt, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison's Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture talking about a mismatch between household size and house and apartment size in Wisconsin. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get the latest in the new Marquette University Law School survey 1 year ahead of 2024 elections. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we heard from the authors of a new book about American girl dolls and their place in American pop culture. A lot of you shared your stories. Here's a couple few more from colleagues here at WPR. Becca writes, my twin sister and I had American Girl dolls growing up. I had Kit, she had Kirsten. While other girls in our school would brag about having all of them, we were happy to each have one. And one of my first jobs, Becca says, out of college was in the marketing department at American Girl. Trina says the American Girl book I read was Kit Kittredge, a girl growing up in Depression-era Cincinnati with a nose for news. Trina says I actually auditioned for the Kit Kittredge at American Girl movie with Abigail Breslin while they were casting in Chicago, but alas, my Hollywood career didn't take off. And Sarah, on the other side of the glass there, says, I was obsessed with the American Girl as a kid. My mom and I would go to the big garage sale in Madison every year, which provided some awesome mother-daughter bonding time. If you have a story to share, you could still do that. Email ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.